I feel like poems have been a good way to enter into these Sunday mornings before we invite the counselors up. So I just wanted to read this one to you, and we'll read it a little bit slow so you can really think about these words. I think it's incredibly powerful. It's called The Gates of Hope by Victoria Safford. Let this be our prayer. Our mission is to plant ourselves at the gates of hope, not the prudent gates of optimism, which are somewhat narrower, not the stalwart, boring gates of common sense, nor the strident gates of self-righteousness, which creak on shrill and angry hinges. People cannot hear us there. They cannot pass through. Nor the cheerful, flimsy garden gate of everything is going to be all right, but a different, sometimes lonely place, the place of truth-telling, about your own soul, first of all, and its condition, the place of resistance and defiance, the piece of ground from which you see the world, both as it is and as it could be, as it will be, the place from which you glimpse not only struggle, but the joy of the struggle. And we stand there, beckoning and calling, telling people what we are seeing, asking people what they see. Amen. Jamie, Mark, and Carrie, why don't you guys come up? Like I said, we have three counselors this morning of different varying degrees. Some of you Whitworth students know Mark Baird and Jamie Korselman, both teach at Whitworth in addition to having private practice. Carrie is my sister-in-law who has private practice and has been doing counseling for what now, 15 years? Almost 20, long time. So these are some incredible human beings, and I'm really excited to have them each up here. Give them a round of applause, as we do everyone, yeah. You get the special mic.
Thank you.
Sorry. Okay, so first question is, maybe just fill us in on a little bit of your background, your experience, what you do as a counselor, how you got to this position. What is there a specific brand or field of counseling that you do, and just a little bit about yourselves. Is that good? All right.
Oh. Sure.
Special mic.
I do have the special mic. All right. So my background, I'm a clinical psychologist. I guess professionally, I was a psychologist in the Army for 4.5 years, some of that in Iraq, and then I was head of the Veterans Outreach Center in Tacoma, working with combat veterans, with families of those who whose family member or loved one died while in the service, for those who had experienced military sexual trauma. And then coming out to Spokane, have shifted into private practice and professoring, if that is a word. It is, because I'm a professor and I can make it a word. So that's kind of just in a nutshell.
Just general private practice?
I work with adults. We were talking about where our specialties are. Yeah, so general private practice. I know I'll let Jamie talk more about relational psychodynamic therapy is kind of what I practice, and if we're going to do a brand, I guess. Yeah.
Well, my name is Jamie Korselman, and I am relatively new to Spokane, about a year and a half, almost 2 years, I guess, this summer. I've been in private practice since 2004, so done it for quite a few years. Lived in Seattle for about 7 years and did that full time. And then in 2010 moved to Auckland, New Zealand, and taught at a school for about 5 years, taught counseling, and then had a private practice, smaller private practice that was more heavy on teaching there. And really wanted to kind of move back to the States and wanted to move back into private practice. I was missing that more and kind of found my calling more in that than the teaching. I love teaching as well. But So move back and have a full-time private practice here and teach one course at Whitworth. My specialty, I guess, if you could say, is I'm a certified sex addiction therapist, so that's been part of what I've done for a lot of years of looking at sexuality and working with men and women and couples kind of in that area. My practice here is probably a little bit more generalized, which I'm enjoying too, and like Mark said, so kind of work from a basis of the experience of therapy that I think is life-changing is not so much the information or the technique of it as much as how the relationship in the room, myself and the person, how that changes, actually both of us, but changes the client. And so I really believe in the power of that relationship and how it can change people.
My name is Carrie Carden, and I have a little different background. I'm a clinical social worker by education. I've had my private practice here in Spokane for, I think 2007 is when I started my private practice. And I opened that up after several years of working with at-risk youth, most of them who were having sexualized behaviors as a result of their own sexual victimization. So I did a lot of sexual abuse work and carried that over into my private practice. And then in about 2008, I took a job as a treatment coordinator for two local group homes. Their staffed residential facilities were super high-risk girls live. They have 24-hour supervision. It's not a lockdown facility, but it's pretty close. There's like one staff to every two girls. And I'm in charge of coordinating all their treatment. I do their diagnoses. I do behavior plans. And these girls are, by the time they come here, they're extremely shut down, resistive, defiant. They're super aggressive and assaultive, and they hate being here. So. I have lots of really great stories about the kind of behaviors I get to see. So my specialty is definitely adolescents. I'd say 100% of my caseload is adolescent girls, and all of them have significant trauma, early childhood trauma, and it's just a snowball effect of generational trauma. So working with them is very challenging. And that's basically, in a nutshell, what I do.
So we have obviously been looking at pain, suffering, trauma, all of this season of Lent. You obviously have a lot of experience in dealing with people who are dealing with pain, suffering, trauma of varying degrees. One of the questions I had for you, which I told you ahead of time, I'm really interested, is how has your personal view or your understanding of pain, of suffering, of trauma, maybe those are different, maybe they're the same, changed or evolved over the years? Given what you've seen and who you've seen and how you've seen it. Maybe you could just talk about what that's been like for you personally. They're all so kind. Oh, they're counselors. They're all like, oh, no, go ahead. I want you to speak first.
Not used to speaking. When I got that question, I think what first came to mind was I think I don't look at circumstances as much anymore. So I used to think pain was kind of associated with how bad the circumstance was. So if you had, you know, major abuse, or you had a death of a loved one, or you had whatever it was, you kind of monitor what the pain was on that basis. And I probably look at it differently now, in that I kind of look at how alone people feel in that pain, so whatever that circumstance is. I think when I see a lot of clients in pain in my office, it's because they feel alone, and they feel disconnected from themselves, from God, from others, and they're in that circumstance, but that circumstance actually drives them further into isolation. And so I would say that's probably how my view of pain has changed. It's not so tied to how bad is the circumstance as much as do they feel alone? And I think even theologically, I think about, you know, Christ's cry on the cross was not so much, gosh, this hurts, like physically, it was, my God, why have you forsaken me? So there's this isolation and I'm abandoned. So I think I feel that from a lot of clients that, you know, when they come in, and then to see the relief on their face when they start to connect with me and go, oh, someone's actually going to listen and not just tell me what to do, but be with me in that. And you experience kind of that, oh, that just that sigh of, oh, I don't have to be alone in this pain. And it makes it a lot easier. So.
Yeah, I would echo that. I would say that how it has changed my view of suffering is it is, and pain, it has expanded it and broadened it. One thing I experienced I think more specifically when I was working with combat veterans, especially around the Vietnam era, was they would come in and they would tell about these horrible things that had happened, but they'd kind of downplay it because there was always a worse story. And so they felt like they didn't deserve to feel as bad as they felt. And part of therapy was helping them own that, no, that was really horrible for you. And often the kicker and the hook was that feeling of isolation in that. So I think seeing the gamut of what causes us distress has really broadened. I mean, even, you know, working with severe population, it can be also very difficult with someone who just, you know, an adolescent who broke up with someone. It's devastating to them. That is their life right there. And feeling that same amount of pain, like very great pain. And sometimes when you've gone through, I guess, big deals, it can be hard then to have empathy for those who are going through smaller deals. But as a counselor, I get to actually hear their story and hear where that angst is and be able to. It's definitely helped my empathy grow for that.
You know, for me, the girls that I see have so much pain that it's acting out physically. They're cutting themselves so severely that they're, you know, in the hospital, or they're swallowing glass, or they're assaulting, they're doing drugs. Their level of pain is just so severe. And I think when I started this work, I was gonna fix it, and they were gonna be high functioning people. So I love what you guys both said. But I've had to just come to, I just have to be able to tolerate that I'm not gonna be able to fix it, and there are no easy answers to anything. And their pain, a lot of times, from my perspective, is just all these secrets that they have. And I don't know if secrets is the right word, but it's just this buried pain that they can't face because it's too dreadful what would happen if they were to face it. So I just try to help them be able to scratch the surface. 9 times out of 10, I can't. So when I think about pain, my girls are living in the worst pain. So I have to just, like what you're saying, empathize with them and be with them in the room. And there are no words for that kind of pain. Does that answer?
Yeah, that's good. I mean, so maybe I'm speaking personally, but I feel like we're in this pain avoidance culture, or I grew up with pain bad. Pain is God's not there, or something's off. And then when there is no pain, God is there, you're doing it right, the formula, et cetera. And there's varying degrees of that in our society, especially in Christianity and in our culture, but your job is to dive into people's pain. So maybe I'm curious also of, do you see a benefit to pain? I can't imagine, you're in this case of almost humans damaging humans, which is just frustrating and drives us mad, I mean, in a way. So, but do you see a beauty in it? Or even personally, when you experience pain, is this thing you try to avoid? I mean, you're in it so much. So do you lessen your avoidance of it and come to accept it, that it's real and it's there and able to deal with it better? I don't know, I'm rambling, but kind of talk about some of that maybe.
No, and the girls that are able to do their work, they can set the bar super high for being vulnerable and examining their destructive patterns and taking accountability for their actions. And then they are sometimes able to be okay. But that's because they're able to face, I don't know, attachment theory calls it the dark hole, the black hole of where humans can't really go to because the pain is so scary. And when you start going into that pain, it's sometimes the behaviors will escalate a little bit because it's so scary. But I think over the years, I've been doing this for almost 20 years, I love it when a client can sit in the pain because that's where the true healing comes. And a lot of times when they're in that kind of pain, from my perspective, there's no words for that. It's just kind of abiding with them. Because sometimes when someone's sitting in this high pain, there are no answers. And answers sometimes when you start talking, that's where the trouble begins, because when someone's in that kind of pain, answers aren't going to fix it. So I love it when I see people be able to sit in that vulnerable spot, because it's really hard to do personally and professionally. It's not easy.
Yeah, one of the things that I often find myself telling clients to, and pain kind of is associated for me with grief, and you're grieving something when you're in pain. And a lot of people don't want to grieve. Like they either want to kind of dismiss it or move on from it or just move away. And I think one of the paradoxical things for me with grief is if you choose to do that way, you actually are devaluing yourself, because whatever you went through is probably worth grieving. And if you don't grieve, you're actually saying, you know what, I'm not worth grieving over, or I'm not even worth the other person if it's, you know, something else. And so when you are able to sit in that grief, paradoxically, I think you're valuing yourself. And so many people come in with this idea of, like, I need more self-esteem, or I need to, you know, value myself more. And yet I think when we move away from pain, we kind of actually devalue ourselves as well. And so I think for me, that's kind of where I've taken the hope of, yes, this is painful and it's really hard, and to kind of sit in it doesn't feel good, because there's this idea of, if I sit in it, am I always going to be here? That's the other kind of fear of, you know, if I sit here, am I just always going to be wallowing in pain and suffering? But I think the people that I see actually move into that and become more comfortable with it begin to value themselves and the world a bit differently, because they start to see the benefit of, you know, the relationships around me, the world around me. They start to see things a little bit differently. So,
yeah, and avoiding doesn't work.
Well, it might be the worst thing, right?
It is. It just makes it bigger and feel worse than it even is. So you've already got a bad, sometimes horrific situation, and so not leaning into that, not what we would call processing it, is it just sits there and grows and feels worse and worse, and the more you avoid, the less you want to lean into it, and so then you just get further away from moving through it. So at least within the room, I've gotten better at leaning into it. I still like to avoid pain in my own life if
sure.
I can.
Yeah.
But it's unavoidable.
Right.
We all will hit it. So
I mean, in that sense, Lent is a really good season for all of us. I mean, and it's not even personal pain necessarily, it's just the pain of the world. And even, I know some of us are hearing, some of us have had stories like you're talking about, but some of us, just the pain is looking at Syria and watching a documentary of these kids being bombed or whatever it is, a news story. What do you do with that kind of pain? That's because that's a different, do you guys go there? Do you go there in a different place because you're a counselor? Does it move you in any different way? Do you have empathy? Do you say, ugh, I'm sad, but I can't do anything? What do you do with that, the pain of the world?
I much rather prefer the pain of the person across from me.
Yeah.
Because I can do something on that. I can be with them. And so, like, I don't really watch depressing movies like I used to, but I feel more helpless in that, like, oh, life is horrible, now what? And so, yeah, I often get asked, oh, how can you hear some of these stories of horrible pain and trauma? But when it's with someone, I feel like, well, I'm doing something, though. I'm there with them. I'm helping them connect in this. So I don't watch a lot of news. I try and keep up just so I know kind of what's going on. But honestly, I don't do a lot of leaning into that kind of pain because I'm left with a real helpless feeling.
Yeah. Maybe, I don't remember how I worded it exactly, but we'll go to the dip here and then we'll pull out. What's some of the worst pain you've seen or in people, or the worst, maybe a moment when you felt the most hopeless or despair for humanity even, or I don't want to get too dark here, but what's been, you look back, I like.
Kind of polls for that.
Yeah. But what's been one of those you look back over your careers and you think, wow, this was really hard, this person. And again, I think for all of us, it's so healthy, empathy for this world, for people's stories, what they're going through, to even hear some of these stories that we may not have heard.
Last summer, I had a client commit suicide, and that was by far the most difficult thing I've been through as a profession. She was my client for about 3 years. And I've heard people say before that, you know, if you've been doing this long enough and you worked with really high-risk kids, you're going to have somebody attempt suicide or commit suicide. And I have had several clients attempt suicide, but this girl, she was 16. She lived at the group home that I work at. Troubled life. I mean, the trauma, I don't even know if you want me to tell you her story or not, but she overdosed on drugs. She heard her biological father, who had abused her significantly, was out of prison, and she went to go find him, and she took off and was on the run for a couple weeks, and her body was found in a park a day or two later. And of course, that was super painful because I really cared about this kid, and she was a great kid, just with a ton of pain. And of course, I do that. I get mad at her that she did that. I feel incompetent as a counselor. So it just stirs up all kinds of things in my own head. And that was probably the most challenging thing for sure that I've been through.
I'll add, which I'm not going to share too much, but Carrie told me a story about a girl recently that. Well, I can't say anything, but basically, I was blown away by this girl's perspective on life and sexuality, and honestly, you told me some pieces of her story, and it's changed the way that I... Can you talk about it a little? I don't know what you can say with confidentiality stuff, but you're going to talk about it way better than me, but I thought that was really enlightening. Honestly, I can't stop thinking about that.
Oh my goodness, this is just a day in the life, right?
I know, exactly.
One of my clients wrote me a letter, and it was about 4 pages long, and Ryan happened to be out of my house, and I was talking to my sister about it, and I said, look at this letter, and there was no identifying information in it, no names, no anything, so I can't get in trouble from Pippa for this. Horrible sexual abuse all growing up from her biological father, who ended up committing suicide when she was 11, and she walked in and found the body. She has a little bit of Asperger's. She's got some major, major mental illness. But she wrote me a letter about how she wants to be raped, and that's all she thinks about, and she's suicidal. She's had a suicide attempt before, but all these ways she's going to kill herself, and then she wants to get pregnant so that she can have a baby and then kill the baby. Right.
Well, just feeling something. Even rape is a form of feeling emotion for her.
Yeah, it was the only way that she would feel love was the pressure of someone raping her. And I know there's kids in here, so I don't go into too much detail.
And I don't want to either, but I think, again, it just opened my eyes to, we tend to put these people in such categories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's our sin. That's our judgment. But it was so good to remember some of the stories and background of these people. Sorry, go ahead, guys.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you ask that question, I actually see more pain in some of the what you might think are minor circumstances. Like that's what comes to mind. Like when I was working in a psych hospital, kind of the year after I graduated, and there was an adult unit and an adolescent unit and a children's unit. And I remember this one day going up to. It was probably a kid, I would guess, probably 4 or 5, about my oldest son's age. And he was just sitting there, kind of, you know, coloring on a table and doing whatever he was doing. And there was a nurse that came in. And I don't know that she, I can't quite remember, but I think she maybe asked him to do something or, you know, just very, something very easily. And he immediately just switched into, like, I've never heard language from an adult, like this kid was saying, just went off on this nurse. And I thought, that's a four-year-old. And I kind of asked her about him later on. She said, yeah, he's here about every month for about 2 weeks. He'll be here. And then, you know, he'll get to kind of a settled place. We'll send him back home, which obviously is a pretty chaotic, not good environment. Then he's back here 2 weeks after. And he's probably going to be a lifer, is what she called it. And you just thought, gosh, like, here's this four-year-old that is supposed to be loving life, feel safe, you know, the cute four-year-old, and all of a sudden he's looking up at this nurse just swearing like a sailor, you know, just laying into her. And I thought, what is that kid going into, you know? And this is his life. It's like this repetition, like Groundhog Day, is happening for him. And so that always stuck with me for whatever reason. I didn't really know the kid, but I think working in a psych hospital really taught me a lot about that. And part of that was, you don't know what's behind the headline, right? There's kind of this, we know the headline story, but we don't know kind of what's underneath that. And so part of that for me is going, we don't know the pain that actually goes into that story. You kind of read the headline of it and you go, oh, well, this is who this is. But we don't know the story of the life, which I often know. And that's what becomes fairly difficult for me is watching that pain and kind of going, oh, there's a lot that goes into that.
Yeah, I went a few different places with that question too. One is perspective, that pain is pain. I think it was interesting to me. Some of the worst pain or most difficult to work with was one in particular that stands out. We'd been working together for a while, and he said, "Mark, I've done something that I will take to my grave. I'll never tell anyone. It was that bad." And so that pain of having done something horrible, what we call the devil's mirror, where you've looked in and realized, oh my goodness, I'm the kind of person who could do that. Now the circumstances, you know, this person was a Vietnam veteran, and Vietnam was just like the Wild West. You know, you put a bunch of 18 and 19 year olds with weapons in a place where they fear for their life with little training. Bad things are gonna happen. You know, and so here's this 60-year-old man who's still living in that action, having that action define him. And I know you're gonna ask later about what success in therapy was. This was probably the most successful, when I think of success, was that before I was moving here, as a gift to me, he told me. Mm. He finally told me what it was. And I was able to look at him and be like, I know this now about you, and I love you. Mm. And so he was no longer isolated in that. But that pain of having victimized, of having done that, of now telling yourself, oh my God, I am a horrible, horrible person. I'm unlovable. I'm unworthy of love. I think that's been one. And then it was interesting to me. I was running a group, and we just happened to get on. All of these members had very severe post-traumatic stress disorder, but they started talking about, it was all men, their childhood and being abandoned by their father. Every one of them had that. So that pulling away, that being isolated, that having someone no longer love you enough to stay, was pain that set them up. But, and in that, left them bereft and it was a great, great pain. Yeah. I think that's...
And again, I hope, I don't do this to be gratuitous and just dive into it, but I think it's so valuable to know what's out there, but also you all come here every Sunday, and this is part of me, to me, being a church body, a community, is to just know what even the people here are dealing with and seeing with and healing and redeeming in some ways. So again, I don't want to say, or be like, tell us more terrible stories, but I think there's such value in it for me, and even to just appreciate you at another level of what you guys do, because I do already, but all of us, and we all have. It's cool, the body of Christ in action. Okay, maybe come out of it a little bit. Humanity, what have you learned about humanity, and maybe even more than that, the divine in humanity and God in this? I mean, of course, it's the cliche question, but where is God in this pain? And maybe what have you learned about the resilience of humanity, or the strength, the courage, the fragility? I don't know where you want to go with that, but what have you learned about us as a species in dealing with so much of our stories?
I guess what I would say to that is, if we don't feel alone, we can go through a whole lot. And that pain, that suffering, becomes a whole lot less. Now, I mean, even if you don't have people there, if you feel connected in some way, even, you know, that's where I think God does come in to the mm-hmm. picture of, if you have that attachment piece, to kind of build on that theory, the pain is there and it's difficult and it's hard, but you can get through it. And I was kind of thinking about even how that changes for me. One of the passages of scripture I use when I teach is this passage in Isaiah, where it's basically, the passage is saying, can a mother forget the child at her breast? And basically goes, you think of that image, and of course not, right? But we hear stories, and that it can be done, right? And scripture goes into it more of, even though that can happen, I as God will not forget you. And then the next image is one of, I will inscribe my name onto my palm, your name onto my palm, which comes from, as I did a little bit of research, in the time of Baal worship, if you were a very good Baal worshiper, you would literally carve the name of Baal into the palm of your hand, which, when you think of the palm of your hand, is pretty, it's a painful thing, right? Nobody gets a tattoo right here. And how God actually turns that on its head and says, no, I will carve your name into my palm, to me says that God experiences pain. Like, there's something that I think, I often think of God as this indifferent kind of judge that doesn't need me, that's not, but yet the picture of scripture is God is in pain when we don't choose him. Like, there's the jealous lover, there's the, oh, I want to be with you. And so that even gives me something of, God is in pain. Like, he experiences pain. And so when I experience pain, I'm not alone. Like, Christ experienced pain. Christ experienced that abandonment, that feeling of being alone. And so I think that's kind of switched for me too, of, there's something about us as humans, if we feel connected, I think we can deal with a lot more.
Yeah, and we have to feel it. Is someone can say, hey, you're not alone, but I still feel alone. We have to feel as though we're not alone, right? Which is a very different thing than just mentally, intellectually acknowledging something, which that's where a lot of what you do comes in, I assume. You have to feel it. And I'm going to help you feel it. Yeah, it's good.
Well, I remember in graduate school studying Carl Rogers and thinking, well, what does this guy know? Because he said, like, you know, there's only three things you need as a therapist, and it's, what is it, empathy, congruence, and unconditional positive regard. I'm like, how easy is that? But now, you know, 20 years later, I look at my girls especially, who come to me with resistance and hatred, and they've had 30 foster homes, they've had 20 therapists, and they're just, they don't want to be there. So I don't care how skilled of a clinician you are, if you don't have those three things in my work, you're going to get nowhere. So when I think about humanity and my specific girls that I see, that's once they feel that, once they believe and know that I care about them, and that I'm not leaving them, and this is after like months of them slamming doors in my face and cussing at me and storming out of session and me showing up consistently each week, we start to form a relationship. And that's what keeps me coming back to work every day, is I get to be the cradler of their pain, and I get to help them kind of, you know, do their work. And some of them do it, and these girls are tough, and they're insightful, and when they can face it and grow, it just gives me hope to keep doing my job every day. Most of them are going to end up on the streets and strung out and probably dead and in prison, but maybe a few of them won't. And that's basically, does that make sense?
Is
that
okay?
And maybe they'll end up strung out and in prison knowing that at least someone loves them.
Yes, and I tell them all the time, like in 10 years from now, when you're making this decision, whatever it is, I want you to think of me, and I want you to remember this conversation we're having, because I want them to have relationships that are healthy and good and all that stuff.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I think some of the most joyous times in therapy is when someone comes in and they're like, and this was going on, and then I thought, well, I know what Mark would say. And I'm like, yes. And usually it's positive.
Yeah, right, right.
You know. Or else it's like, all right, good.
Well,
I'm glad you can
too,
let that go.
That.
So when we can internalize someone, you know, we have that ability. And when we have, the great thing is with attachment, you know, you have horrible childhood and really bad. But when you can have a relationship with someone who's secure, who's constant, who's there, who loves you when you slam the door in their face, you know, it's funny sometimes to watch people test the limits of like, are you still gonna love me even though, yeah, I know you told me I should do this, but I did the opposite, now what? You know, and it's like, well, let's talk about that, let's explore that. Oh, really? Okay. You know, what I have found about humanity is that we're all trying the best to do the best that we can with the tools we've been given. And that when you can clear away a lot of these things, like, you know, a lot of your girls have learned that the other is very sharp and mean and horrible. And so their self has to hide. So many of my clients have to hide because it's protective. They can't survive otherwise. And so providing a place where maybe it's more safe for their true self to come through. I go back to when God created us and said, it is very good. I truly believe that at the core of us is something that is very good. And it's fun to see when that can shine from others. And when they can internalize someone cheering them on and saying, you can do this, and I love you in this, and you're worth showing up for. You know, personally, Ryan, the other day at the book club, we were talking about this, how this kind of has affected me personally. And someone had come and told me, I was at a basketball game, and I'm fairly calm most of the time, but at basketball games, like Whitworth games, I'm not. I go a little and And I was up with my son and cheering really, and it was opposite the student section. So I had a student come in the other day and said, oh, hey, Dr. Baird, a bunch of students saw you and they were making fun of you and kind of mocking you. And I was like, oh, okay. And then after she left, I was just like devastated. I just could picture them making fun of me. And all of a sudden that little boy Mark came up to the surface. And so at the first time I really got to talk about it was at the book club, and you guys kind of helped me. You know, one of the images that I got that really was transformative was of Christ coming alongside me and cheering with me and being excited for my excitement and having his arm around me and having that relational component there. And after that, after I could get that image of Christ loving me in my shame Now, this is kind of a dumb example, but it still hurt. But of having Christ loving me in that was transformative. And it was like, okay, I am okay. And so if I can be that, if I can be Christ for my clients and come alongside them and be like, yeah, you're loved.
Yeah. Segue into, you've all kind of said it, what would you want humanity to hear or understand or believe or feel? But maybe in addition to that, what you've all kind of hinted at is you're not alone, you're loved. How do we do that? And not just you. I mean, in some ways, they come in, you get an hour with these people a week or whatever it is. How do we, as a society and a culture, communicate to humanity what you think should be communicated to humanity? And that's a big question, but I don't know. It's still a worthy question to ask. I mean, I think we're always asking it around here, but what's your perspective on that, or ideas?
Well, my first thought's pretty simple. It's like we all know that everybody has a story, and I think it's just not judging, and I think it's, like I said earlier, biting with people, and just sometimes there's no answers. It's just loving, and I think that's my success with my girls, is that they know I'm not going anywhere. And pretty soon, you know, one day she's cussing in my face and slamming a door, and then 3 months later she's asking me for a hug at the end of our session. And so I think it's just not giving up on people, and that's probably way too simple of an answer for you, but
no,
for me that's kind of what it is, and it's just loving.
Yeah. I'm always, when you give an answer like that, I'm never going anywhere. It's amazing to me what we've done with our theology of God. It's so hard for, God isn't going anywhere. God is always showing up, spitting in his face, slamming the door, her face, whatever it is. The divine is there, always loving. And we come up with all these theologies of why the divine's leaving or is angry or wanting to punish us. And it's again, amazing. It's so simple. And yet so hard, right? But it's beautifully said.
My life motto is to be fully seen and fully loved is transformative. Mm. So starting to see people, like, and love them. And I had to kind of, and actually being able to hear people's stories, like, I'm very blessed to do this, you know, as a profession, to hear people's story, has expanded, as I said, my empathy. And so I just assume that everyone has a story. And so it's been very refreshing not to have to judge people, not to be like, oh, look at them doing this or that, they're doing that. Because I just assume, you know what, they're probably doing the best they can, and I'm doing the best I can. They're probably mad at me, too. You know, I'm not everyone's cup of tea.
Yeah.
And so I think starting to see people is where we can start. Just noticing them and looking them in the eyes and saying hi, and then being willing to listen as non-judgmentally as we can. Tell me your story. But I think just first acknowledging their humanity, looking them in the eyes and saying hi, is where we can start.
Yeah.
Because I've heard from many a client who feels like they're invisible in society.
Hmm.
That people won't look at them, and that is, like, the mother's gaze is so important, or, you know, in attachment. Like, that's the first place we start to get that. Well, when we're not getting that from society either, we can just start going, feeling more and more isolated. So if we can be one of those people who looks at them and says, hi, it's good to see you, and to mean it,
mm-hmm.
and to love them when they're smelly or they're different or whatever, it has helped me be happier. I mean, it's a co-created thing.
Yeah. Which, even as you're speaking, I have the groups of people that are easy to be with and hear their story. Then I have the groups of people that are hard, but I've accepted that I'm supposed to hear their story, so I'm okay with it. And then I still have kind of these people. Not you guys.
Yeah, but the left side, right there.
Usually they sit over here.
Talking to you.
and the left side. No, but it's, even in my head, it's, oh yeah, but then there's also those people who have a story. So convicting and so good and beautiful. But there's so many people we instantly write off, whether it be on the news, whether it be the way they voted, whether it be their religion, whether it be their sexuality, whether it be their whatever. We are so good at labeling people and writing them off. And it's such a good reminder, which I think Lent has been to some degree here. Everyone has a story. My brother says there are no monsters. And there are no monsters. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, it made me think of one of the first years when I was teaching in New Zealand. I had the class. It was a beginning counseling course. And at the end, I had them turn to a partner. And I had them just, without saying anything, look into the other person's face. And I timed it for about a minute before you could feel the tension just up in the room. Like, this is the hardest thing they probably did in the 3 years of their education, was to just simply turn and face somebody and not say anything and just look them in the face. And there was something really powerful about it. Like, I would feel uncomfortable doing that. And so I kind of thought, well, maybe I need to not do that anymore because I'm not doing it. So, but when you think about, that's, I think, what we need to do, because the aspects of that are, first of all, slowing down. I mean, for me, that's such a huge thing. And what is the benefit of counseling for me is I do slow down. Like, in that hour, my mind is on the person, right? That's my job. I don't have to think about anything else. And that is a rarity, I think, in the world. Like, in my own life, that's a rarity, to slow down enough to go, okay, I'm going to take some time and actually listen to my wife. Like, how was your day? That's hard, and that's hard for everybody to do, I think. The other part of it that I see is vulnerability. I mean, Mark was just a bit vulnerable now, and I'm like, oh, I want to hear more. Yeah. Like, there's this connection that we have when we allow ourselves to be vulnerable, then other people go, oh, I want more of that. But it takes strength to be vulnerable, and it takes something of, I'm okay, and I'm connected with people. I have that ability to be okay when I'm vulnerable. I don't have to think that this is going to define me. And so that's part of what I think can happen too, because someone can ask you all day long, how are you, and even give you the space, but if you're not vulnerable, it's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think those are the aspects, at least when I look at my own life too, that I'm constantly having to remind myself. Yeah. And it's pretty easy as a therapist I'm seeing everybody else's vulnerability all day long, but how am I actually being vulnerable? Mm-hmm. So I ask myself even that in session sometimes, like, how am I being vulnerable here?
Yeah. Yeah. To echo your gazing, I haven't had a yoga story in a while, but my wife and I did acro yoga, which was pretty impressive. You know, the little holding her up and all this stuff. Then she held me up. We did all this stuff. Then we ended with gazing, which was 5 minutes. You sit this far apart and you look in each other's eyes for 5 minutes. And, you know, they're telling us, no, some people cry, some people laugh. And my wife and I are like, this brother, we're Ryan and Heidi. I mean, we love each other. We know each other. We're not going to do anything. This is going to be normal. We look at each other all the time. 30 seconds in. Just sobbing. I mean, both of us are just sobbing. And then we had to do it for 5 minutes. And that's my wife. But echoing your story, wow, it is so hard to look at someone in the eye and to really see them as a human. And if it's that hard with my wife, or that emotional maybe, imagine the person on the street who we just walked by. Which I have made intention, even if I do nothing else, to just, hey, I see you. Okay, last question was, what does success look like? But you've kind of answered some of that, so maybe a little bit different would be, how has all of this going into pain and darkness and dealing with it revealed something beautiful about humanity to you, even about yourself, about God, about hope, about light. Maybe just end with a good story or a good moment. And it, again, I love that the girl who still commits suicide on the street, strung out, but knowing she's loved is success. And that's hard for us to accept, but there's a truth to that. So maybe just the thing that you've seen or that gives you hope or a beautiful, inspiring thing about humanity to end with.
Oh, I've got so many, I'm just trying to filter out, just so you know.
Probably do, yeah. Is it that bad? Jeez. Oh my gosh. I'm like, wow. There's nothing.
It's not that bad.
Okay,
it's
good.
Just trying
good.
To figure out.
Yeah.
Which one?
Okay, yeah. Good. I'm glad you're, there's a lot.
And so I think what I took away from that is I never know how I'm going to be effective. I can see kind of places where I feel the relationship is doing something, but if I try or I try and be sneaky or I try and maneuver, it's not going to work. And so I guess all that I'm saying in that is being yourself and being your authentic self and just kind of responding is such a gift. And so I kind of take that away as, you know, that's something about humanity. The things that we think we're doing really well probably aren't even being seen. And the little things that you just do that you would never consider are actually the moments that change people. At least that's what I've learned.
Well, I think for me, I've quit trying to answer the question, you know, why are some people so cursed and others so blessed? And just trying to figure all that out. And last week we were on vacation on the Oregon coast, and I went for a run on the beach, and I just was observing all these families together, like kids and moms and dads, and I just was overwhelmed. Like, there are good people, and for me, success as a therapist is just doing the best I can, just exactly what you're saying. I think it's just being able to sit with them in that, and being able to go home, and when a secret or something really scorches me, I can go home and I can hug my family, and I just have really beautiful things in my life that are happening that help me do a better job. And I just being able to abide in that is to me success.
It's hard to pick out specific examples, but I'll say that I have been continually reminded of how resilient we are as humans, that clients have told me horrific things or have been so shut down or have been so mean to themselves. The things we can tell ourselves. Some of you are very gifted, right? At like really being critical of finding. At 5 a.m, I'm very gifted. Like, I just wake up like, you just said the stupidest thing, now you're gonna get fired, you're such a horrible, you know, thank you, I'm very gifted at this, you know? But of watching them shift, and of watching them be able to sometimes grow from the trauma. When horrible things happen, it totally destroys our idea of what the world is. And sometimes that can be a good thing because we can rebuild it with what it actually is. And so there are times when I see this the flexibility of trying new things and of being kind to themselves, even for a little bit. And so I have more hope that there can be even subtle shifts, and sometimes really large ones, you know, and those I take. I'm like, oh, like, I think some of the easy ones are when people aren't sleeping well. I can do that real, real good. Oh, I feel like a successful therapist. But other times when they say, oh, yeah, I was starting to really be down on myself, but then I thought, oh, no, I'm doing the best I can. I'm like, oh, success. You know, but there are people who take their tragedy and grow and have an understanding of God and of others That's pretty amazing. And again, to be in the room with them and get to know them is a gift.
Well, I would just say again in front of everyone, thank you for doing what you do. I mean it. It's really hard job, and I think so many of the people who have been up here for Lent have been people that I respect a ton. I'm grateful for that you're in this world with the attitude you are and interacting with people and loving them the way that you are. So it's an honor to know you, and it's a gift to have you here at Branches. So again, part of this season is talk to these people. There's so many incredible people just in this room whose stories we don't know, and even begin there and encourage one another and cry with one another and celebrate with one another and be with one another, and we are not alone. So thank you for being up here this morning. Thank you for doing what you do every day. Give them a round of applause. Let's end with a prayer. God, we are grateful for this place. We are grateful for this life we get to live. And we are grateful for the reminder of Lent that there is pain, there is darkness, there is suffering, there is trauma, and there is light. And there is hope, and there is healing, and there is redemption. And often that does not look like what we want it to or expect it to. But it is true that we are loved. It is true we are valued. It is true we are not alone. Help us to feel it. Help us as humans to give that gift to other humans. Help us to be the body of Christ and to remind those around us that we are valuable more than we can even imagine. May we feel your love, especially this week as we go into Good Friday and Easter. Thank you again for this season. Thank you again for your love for us. In Jesus' name, amen. Have an awesome week. Go in grace and peace.